On today's episode of Coding 101, Raphael Mudge, security expert extraordinaire and guy who programs things and stuff for hackers.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want when you want with access to over 2,700 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit Lynda.com/C101. That's Lynda.com/C101.
Welcome to Coding 101. It's the TWiT show where we let you into the wonderful world of the code monkey. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I am Shannon Morrison. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to get you all coded up on everything you need to know about a security expert.
Yeah, that's right, folks. This is one of our wild card episodes. You may remember that we've done this before, where in between our 8-week modules, we take a break to actually talk to someone who programs for a living. The idea behind this is to show you what can happen to you if you take these lessons to heart. So without further ado, we welcome our security expert, my security guru, Mr. Raphael Mudge, the Armitage hacker from Penn. He's a pen tester. Raphael, can you tell the folks, where can they can find you?
Sure. Hi, I'm Raphael. And you can learn a little bit about the work I do. I actually develop software to hack into systems to test their security. And you can learn about that at www.advancedpentest.com.
Okay. Now we're going to back up. We got the plug in. Now what we wanted to do is actually talk about you, because I know the work that you do, and Snubs knows the work that you do, because you've worked with her on her show as well, just as well as you've worked on mine. But your specialty is interesting. You go beyond white hat, black hat, gray hat. You're a guy who programs who happens to know security really, really well. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Oh, sure. Okay, so what's the best place to start? I always say I'm a developer first. Everything I have or do is because I like to program. And I happen to be working in the security space. And I have my own company now, but I was active duty Air Force before for 4 years. And
thank you for your service, sir.
Thank you very much, Snubs. No, it was definitely a labor of love. I bleed blue, as they say.
Yeah.
And yeah, very nice. So, by the way, you see this beard? This is what happens if you apply all the coding lessons. You will grow a nice, fluffy beard.
You have, Shannon. You do. You have a coding beard. I just shaved mine, so I'm very, very clean shaven. Yes. So
it looks nice.
Yeah, he just shaved his too. But thank you. Your beard is awesome.
I can't grow a beard.
Thank you. So, yeah. Anyways, yeah. Back question. My background. So, yeah, I was active duty Air Force. I worked as a researcher for the Air Force in cyber operations. And this is one Padre might not know about me. When I left the Air Force, I invented a spelling and grammar checker called After the Deadline. And I sold it to a guy named Matt Mullenweg, who created WordPress.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And so if you have a WordPress.com, yeah. So if you have a WordPress.com blog, and you go check your spelling or grammar, you're actually using my software right now to do that.
There's always a little piece of you in there. I like.
Oh
that.
Yeah, no, that's after the deadline's me.
Wow, it's a small world. That's cool.
I am a grammar checker grammar teacher to millions of people through my programming efforts.
So when did you actually learn programming? Was it before you got into the Air Force, or was it during the Air Force?
It was in high school.
Okay.
I always wanted to be a journalist when I grew up, because I like writing, strangely enough. It helps.
So how does journalism turn into programming?
Oh, man. What is the best way to put it? So how does journalism turn into programming? Well, when I was a teenager, I spent a lot of time on internet relay chat. That's where I learned everything. Hi, chat room. You're doing a good thing for yourself. And I was always on IRC, like, you know, as a 14-year-old kid. Didn't know that that was like anything cool. And I really wanted to learn C++ because that's what you needed to know if you were going to be a hacker. And I didn't know that was something I wanted to be. I didn't know that it could become a career because at that time, nobody thought of it that way. So I always thought by default, I'd be go and be a journalist. And I just eventually got more and more into computers. And that became my career, I guess, best way to put it.
Why were you so interested in hacking at such a young age, though?
What else do you do with computers?
So you were a nerd at heart.
Always. Oh, man, if I were to meet my 14-year-old self, my 14-year-old self, I think, would be like, nice beard, but you should shave. No, but no, my 14-year-old self, I think, would be really happy, like, between, like, all the anime art with my product and the hacking stuff. I just had a fascination with it, probably from, like, you know, it's computers. Like, oh, it's a computer. What do you do with it? So, I mean, I started doing what every kid does. And that's like, no, there was no Google back then. I mean, it was BBS. BBS is where I start. So, you know, downloading files, chatting with people and meeting other people my age and them saying, hey, come look at this. Hey, take a look at this text file on this floppy disk and just stuff I shouldn't be looking at. And it was really intriguing to me.
Raphael, what was your first computer?
My first computer, my mom bought a Commodore 128 at a garage sale, and it had a monochrome monitor, couldn't do graphics, could do text, and I would do some basic programming on that, but I didn't see myself as a programmer, just did some stuff with basic, and then it was a Pac Bell, it was a 486 DX2.
Oh, yes. Okay.
1994.
Woohoo. Back in the DX series. So your first programming language would have been what on this 486 DX2?
You ready to laugh?
Pascal.
I don't know if you'll laugh. No, and Shannon's got like the, I better laugh because it'll be funny. No, you guys ever heard of MIRC?
Of course.
Yeah.
Merc chat?
Yeah.
I keep forgetting, like, we have an IRC chat room
that's
for
right.
The show right,
right
here.
Right in there, yeah.
I'm watching the room too, so. Yeah, it was Merc scripting.
Oh, okay.
MIRC has a scripting language built into it, and I learned programming or got really into Merc scripting when I was a teenager.
That's awesome.
Well, now that you've progressed past Merc scripting.
Oh, come on. There is no progressing past that. That is the pinnacle of hacking, Padre. Do not diss on Merc
scripting. We know better than that. You're a programming expert. You've been doing this for a long time, so your knowledge encompasses many languages. But beyond Merc scripting, do you have a favorite language? Do you have a language that you default to constantly?
So I have a very weird... Yes and no. So I tend to believe in having kind of three types of languages in your arsenal, really four. The first one is, and no, from the chat room, Cool Breeze, LFS was not where I worked. That came out of Wright-Patterson. That was the anti-tamper folks.
Oh.
So guy asked an Air Force question about their lightweight portable security distribution. So I had to answer for that. Anyways, so what should folks know? So for systems programming, I love programming in C, straight up C. And I do a lot more work in C now, which I really enjoy. It makes me happy. I think everybody should know a scripting language. And for me, that was Perl back in the day. I really loved Perl. And now I actually have all this stuff here with me, some books. I actually program in a language now called Sleep, which I wrote about 10 years ago.
Whoa, wait. You wrote a language.
I did.
I had college roommates like you who were like, you know what? I don't like any of these languages. I'm going to break it.
I'm just going to write my own.
Yeah, exactly. What made you write a new language?
I wanted to learn. I learned by programming, actually.
Wow.
So, Snubs, you'll appreciate this. Mm-hmm. A lot of people know me for something called Armitage, right? Which is the front end for Metasploit that allows a team to collaborate. I wrote Armitage to learn Metasploit.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
Everything I do is I build stuff to learn. Programming to me is a tool to explore a problem.
And Metasploit, for anybody that doesn't know, it's a pen testing program for hackers, basically.
Yeah, it's a great thing. It's a great project.
You know, before we go any further, I'm thinking we know what you do because we've both worked with you in the past. But there's going to be a segment of our audience who they don't know anything about security penetration testing. They don't know anything about Metasploit. They know nothing about Cobalt Strike. Can you tell them in the most basic terms that you can think of to someone who's just starting to code? What is it that you do? We know that you wrote a front end for Metasploit.
Right.
We know that you wrote your own language. But why? Why do all of that for a framework like Metasploit? Why do all that to write something like Cobalt Strike?
Okay, sure. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Metasploit, let me start at the basics of what that is. Hackers, to break into systems, one of the things we like to do is take advantage of mistakes other programmers made. We call them vulnerabilities. And we use a software called an exploit, which takes advantage of that hole to give us access. And Metasploit is an open source collection of exploits written by many, many people. We're talking hundreds, if not, I would say it has to be in the high hundreds of contributors, but I don't know the exact number. It's a big community in terms of people who write modules. Now, Metasploit's great, but used by itself, it's kind of a pain to do a lot of, like, to actually work at scale, work against a bunch of targets, or even collaborate. So I came along and wrote a tool called Armitage that's open source and allows a team of hackers to collaborate using Metasploit. So if you hack into a system, like if Padre hacks into a system, snubs Padre and I see the look, we can use that system at the same time. And that took off. It was very successful as a project. And I started my own company, and I created a product called Cobalt Strike to really push the edge on some ideas I had about hacking and actually, instead of building like collaboration stuff, to focus on building new hacking tools that work with all this stuff. And that's what I do for a living now, for the past couple of years, actually.
Now, there is one question that I have for you, and it involves the programming side, because one of the things that we've been teaching a lot is sanitizing your inputs, sanitizing your code whenever you do things. And this is because you have hackers in the world that can do different kinds of exploits. So what I want to know is there any kind of certain code flaw that you've run into a lot that you've exploited the most? Like, what is your favorite thing to exploit?
Okay, so the question, I'm so used to like conference talk. The question was, so what is my favorite thing to exploit? So for me, philosophically, I actually prefer not to go after flaws. I prefer to abuse the way things work.
Oh,
and that would make sense because I'm a programmer, right?
Yeah.
I want to do things that work because they're reliable. So in terms of getting access to a system, my favorite way to do it is through what we call user-driven attacks. And that's an attack that abuses a feature, but if the user like follows through on that feature, it gives me, the attacker, code execution. And let me give you an example of a very simple, almost lame user-driven attack.
Nothing is lame here.
No, that's fine. A favorite technique, and we're talking even like allegedly nation state actors do this. It's silly. A favorite technique is to create an executable and change its icon with a program called a resource editor to look like a document, okay? And send that to your target. And when the target sees that executable, they think it's a document because it might be named like document.pdf.scr.
Yeah.
And by the way, an SCR file is an executable. It's just renamed, and a screensaver, you can just run it and it'll work like a normal exe. Anyways, if somebody opens up that document, it runs your malware, and then in the background, it drops a document to disk and opens it up like nothing ever happened. And that's an extremely common attack.
That's awesome.
That's just weird because, I mean, that sounds like one of those attacks that should have become extinct.
Yep.
Long ago.
I think that's how I got my first virus.
Yeah. How many times do we tell people, look, don't open attachments. Don't run documents.
I thought it was a screen. I thought it was a screensaver.
Yeah, someone sends it's you know someone's email gets compromised and it sends out a bulk email message to all the contacts saying, "Oh, this is a beautiful screensaver of puppies.
Oh, pretty waterfall."
Yeah.
That's what mine was. It was a waterfall. My dad got super mad at me because I downloaded this what I thought was a screensaver. Never worked, but I got a virus.
Is that the most consistent vector, would you say? Still taking advantage of users doing users' things rather than weaknesses in the code base itself?
Yes, and especially more so now. Right now, I'm doing a series for my own YouTube channel where I'm going through these reports from different threat intelligence companies. And those are companies that look at intrusion sets, people who are actually stealing intellectual property, and write about how they do it. And on the most recent version of TWiET, we actually went through one of those where we looked at an actor and how they do things with Security Onion JJ. There's a guy in the chat room talking about how awesome Security Onion is. Great project, by the way. Anyways, one of the things I'm doing, though, is going through these reports and reproducing those attacks. And I'm getting frustrated because so many of these reports of how these people steal intellectual property start with the executable as a fake document attack. And I'm like, come on, guys, do something more creative than this, please, so I can demo it. So I'm struggling to find other things, but Java is a very common vector to try to get execution as well, code execution. And my personal favorite is to embed a macro into a Word document or Excel spreadsheet, because Word macros, they sound harmless. They can do anything that a native program can do. And that goes for Mac OS X as well, by the way, not just Windows.
Wow.
We're speaking with Raphael Mudge, the Armitage hacker, pen tester extraordinaire, security expert extraordinaire, who just happens to program. We'll be right back. We're going to talk to him a little bit about the inspiration that he finds when he looks for these exploits. But before we do that, I thought we should take a break and, well, talk a little bit about our first sponsor. That's Lynda.com.
Lynda?
Yeah, I love me
I
some
love
Lynda.
Lynda.
Yeah. Now, Lynda is your one-stop shop for online knowledge. Anytime you need to know something about anything, you're probably going to find it on Lynda.com. They're not just about technology. They're not just about programming or about computers. You'll find a wide variety of topics on Lynda.com because that's what they do. They want to be the place that you go to find your reference, to find your training. Now, Lynda.com helps you to learn and keep up to date with your software, to pick up brand new skills and explore new hobbies with these easy-to-follow videos that you see up on screen. Whether you want to master the fundamentals of programming, learn a new programming language like Python, or design and develop engaging websites, Lynda.com offers thousands of courses in a variety of topics. Lynda.com recently released a new iPhone and iPad app for iOS 7, and they enhanced their Android app to provide Chromecast support, which means you've got more options to watch their content. The iOS app includes a more visual, intuitive interface, and both new apps offer offline courses and video viewing, which makes it easy and convenient to learn even in environments that don't have internet access. Lynda.com users can move seamlessly between mobile and desktop applications. That's one of the things I really like, because it means you can start on your desktop and move to your tablet and maybe drop over to your phone and then back over to your laptop. Now, what I've seen the last couple of weeks is that I've seen Lynda really up their game. They have new courses that include things like the Android Essential Training, the Creating Mobile Games with Unity program, the WordPress Developer Tips, and much, much more. Now, we've been using Lynda here at TWiT for a while, especially since we've been making the move over to Premiere. Our editors all worked with Final Cut Pro, so Lynda.com was an invaluable site for them to either remember the things that they used to do on Premiere and they forgot when they moved to Final Cut, or to learn it all anew. And that's one of the things I love about Lynda, which is with their transcripts, it means that you don't have to watch an entire lesson to find that one nugget. For example, if you want to know, how do I do chroma keying in Premiere? You would type chroma key and it would direct you to the exact time code, the place that will show you the technique within Premiere. That's just invaluable. It's one of the tools that Lynda.com offers as part of the package. They've got over 2,700 courses with more added weekly. And all Lynda.com courses are produced at the highest quality, not like homemade videos on YouTube. And we're not knocking those YouTube videos. In fact, you know, that's how most of us here at Twitch started. But sometimes you want professional video done right, with good lighting, with good audio, with good angles, with someone who knows how to work a camera. And that's what Linda does. It gets all that other distraction out of the way and gives you pure knowledge in a way that you want to learn. Lynda.com works with software companies to provide you updated training the same day that the new versions hit the street. That means that you'll always have the very latest skills, and their instructors are accomplished professionals at the top of their fields, and they're passionate about teaching. And it all shows through in their videos. Whether you have 15 minutes or 15 hours, Lynda.com has the course for you, beginner, intermediate, or advanced. You know that they'll have the knowledge that you're looking for. Lynda.com also offers certificates of completion when you finish a course, which you can publish to your LinkedIn profile, which is great if you're a professional in the field and you want potential employers to know what you've trained in. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try Lynda.com for all your knowledge needs. It's only $25 a month for access to the entire Lynda.com course library, or for $37.50 a month, you can subscribe to the premium plan, which includes exercise files that let you follow along with the instructor's project using the exact same project assets that they do. And you can try Lynda.com right now with a free 7-day trial. Visit Lynda.com/C101 to access the entire library. That's over 2,700 courses free for 7 days. That's LYNDA.com/C101. And we thank Linda for the support of Coding 101. Raphael, getting back to you, my friend, one of the questions that I have for you is, well, I'm sorry, I'm getting a wave off. I'm getting hits. Okay. Can you put a bug here? Thank you. That's going to scare Josh. Okay. I'm going to come back to my question. Raphael, one of the questions that I've had is where you get the inspiration for looking for these exploits. Because I'd say it's this weird combination. You need to be a good programmer because you need to know where they probably put the flaws in their code, or you need to know where they put the flaws in their process, which I think is what you go after. But you also need to have sort of the trollish glee of finding something wrong, finding something unique that only you would know about.
Are you calling Mudge a troll?
I'm in the best possible way. Mudge is a great troll. but Raphael, how do those things come together in your mind?
Okay, sure. So why is Twitter successful? This does relate to your question. Why is it easy to write on Twitter or to write a tweet?
They make it easy for consumers. They simplified it. It's very simple.
Okay, and there's one other reason, too.
Pretty?
It's track
144.
Oh, so short, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's very
144
short.
144 characters. Okay. So with Twitter, one of the reasons it's so popular is because of constraint. Everybody's given this default constraint to work with, 144 characters, and you're allowed to be creative within that space. And I see hacking a lot like that. Sometimes I find folks will try to pick something, anything in this big universe of all possible things to do, when what will really make you successful as a hacker is narrowing in and focusing on something. And let me give you an example from my own experience. When I was doing production red teaming, I do a lot of exercise support now, but I had just done a reconnaissance shot against my target. And what I did was I sent a web application or sent a link to a web application to a few people in this organization. And those people clicked. It was a LinkedIn invitation. And it came to my server. And my web application discovered all this information about their systems and then sent them on to LinkedIn.com like nothing ever happened. And what that gave me was a constraint. It gave me, here's what my target has. This is the things running on their system. And now when I had to come up with an attack, it wasn't, okay, let me pick something cool that's random. It's, I need to sit here in this box I've been put into and come up with something that's going to work here. And for me, I find when I have good constraints, good assumptions, good things that narrow what I have to do, that's where the magic really happens, because I can be creative within that space and there's not that much room to spin out of control and end up in a lot of different directions.
So you like to constrain yourself whenever it comes to programming.
Absolutely. I like to constrain myself when it comes to programming and attacking something, finding the problem I'm going to use. And constraint is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And that's what reconnaissance gives you. It gives you constraints, so you know what the reality you're dealing with is.
That's really interesting. You know, it kind of makes me think of, in a lot of programming, you have constraints that you have to deal with. You are restrained to the rules of a different programming language, and each one is so different. You have to stay within those rules to make your program work. So I totally get that.
I guess reconnaissance. Yeah. So what Mudge does is when he reconnoiters a particular system, he's looking at the constraints that they work with, because that's going to necessarily affect the way that the programmers worked to both code and to guide the process of data through the system. So that's – I've never thought about that. But, yeah, I guess
– But it totally makes sense.
It really makes sense now. That's how you hunt for vulnerabilities.
And this is why we have our experts on the show. Now I have another question for you.
Sure.
Programming is awesome, and I get super excited whenever things work. But what was your aha moment? What was the moment when you were just like, yes, complete?
Oh, wow. Okay, so I have to tell you this. Nobody believes me because, I mean, I do so much programming now.
I'll believe you.
When I was in high school, make no mistake about it, I did not know how, like, a program would come together, like a bigger thing. Like, I told you I could do the scripting with, like, MerkChat. But I could not put together in my head what would become, like, how to build or architect an application. I just did not do this. And I actually... In a way, like, I remember dreaming about what that would be like to be able to imagine something and create it. And I know I wanted that. And I want to say that one of the big aha moments for me, it sounds funny, was when I learned Perl. Because Perl gave me the ability to do a lot of things very quickly and to start to, like, kind of experiment and spread my wings. And being able to do CGI scripts so I could actually do, like, web applications, if you will, allowed me to kind of go beyond that knowledge and start doing more with it. So I always kind of consider Perl the first language I became very strong with. And I owe it, like, a deep debt of gratitude, because it really gave me so much joy.
Raphael, I want to ask you this. It sounds as if a lot of your programming training came out of just your passion. You mm-hmm. found a language, you liked it, you learned it, and you used it to do something with it. There's another group of people who have had formal training in all the languages that they've done. And by formal training, I mean in a formal setting, either a university or in some sort of educational environment, who would look at that sort of training and they'd say, well, no, you just didn't learn it right. That's not the way you're supposed to program. That's not the way you're supposed to think. What would be your takeaway? I mean, both sides are valid, but why did you go down one path rather than the other?
Okay, sure. So I kind of have familiarity with having my foot in both worlds. I'm a computer scientist, and I've got a bachelor's and a master's in it, so I have gone the formal path as well. And as you know from my research background, I mean, I've worked in a very formal, academic-ish research environment doing research. And that's the way I look at research. Sorry, I just like laughing at myself on Skype. So I got to tell you, though, I don't see anything special about the quote unquote formal way. I think formal is, and I've butt heads with colleagues over this. I see the formal things as a way of trying to capture the experience of very experienced people. So if you've got if you're an ad hoc self-taught person and you have a lot of experience, you're probably going to do a lot of the things that the formal way people who believe in different kinds of methodologies are doing it naturally, because you've stumbled on what works and what doesn't. You're going to gravitate away from what doesn't work. So, but the formal method, or not formal methods, is different. But the formal structured way of doing programming, all these methodologies, it can work to try to help keep people on the same page and help an effort from getting out of control and keep people from making silly mistakes. So there's merit to that too. And one thing I actually want to, I have it here. It's along these lines.
Show and tell.
Show and tell. If you ever get a chance, one of the people who's written best about this kind of thing is a guy named Joel Spolsky. And I'm a really big Joel Spolsky fan. And he's got this great book. It's a little bit older now, but completely relevant, all of it. It's called Joel on Software. And he very much gives his philosophy on how much formal is enough to let not get in the way, but still keep a team glued together. And he's a great balance between those two worlds.
Nice. Nice. I do want to ask you to maybe delve into something that you can or cannot talk about. I'm going to leave it up to you. But I know you've done a lot of red on blue exercises. Can you talk about what that is, why you do it, and where you do it?
Let's see here.
Yeah, what is
I can
red
talk about the ones
blue.
I talk about. Well, no, okay. That's kind of a funny thing. So I do actually, I provide a lot of exercise support. There's one, the just so you don't think I'm being too dodgy, the after action report for this exercise I was in will come out in August, and it was a very big one. It was professional blue teams, military
blue teams. Wait, before we go any further, can you tell us
sure.
what is a red on blue
sure. A red team is in an exercise, like a simulated, like a cyber war. An exercise is where you have a bad guy, usually the red team, and their job is to simulate a credible threat for people who are learning or getting training on how to better defend networks, and we call those people blue teams. And I provide a lot of support to those kinds of events, and one of the ones most publicly I do is called the Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition. And that's actually with college students as blue teams, and that's done on a volunteer basis. And I've been doing that since 2008.
Does it take more experience to be on red team or on blue team, or is it about the same?
It's a good question. So usually you have – usually the training audience is the blue team, okay? But in my opinion, it takes a lot more skill to be a really good blue teamer than it does to be – a decent red teamer. So good red teamers are usually very highly skilled, but we can get a lot out of a junior red teamer, where on a blue team, if you're going to be successful as a blue team, you really need a lot of skill. And it's a very, very hard job.
Yeah, I would just be thinking, as a trainee, I would hate to be on the blue team, because it seems like the blue team would always be getting its butt kicked, especially if you've got a bunch of newbies.
Oh, they do. Always. That's part of the fun.
Yeah, it's part of the training, correct?
Of course, training. But we'll call it training.
The training.
You know what the trick is to that, though? In that kind of scenario, and this goes into even penetration testing, the trick is good client management. So if, like me as an offensive professional, I do offensive work, it's very important to, what's the word I'm looking for? It's very important to have good client management skills. And what I mean by that is make sure that you never come across as adversarial or disrespectful to the people you're essentially working yes. with.
I absolutely agree with you. You know, there's a lot of times that I've gone to hacker cons or I've gone to different, you know, clubs or whatnot, and people do, they do kind of look down on you if you don't understand everything that they're talking about. And I'm one to question everything, so they always look down on me.
That's a
except yeah, for I, you, Mudge. Except for you.
Thank you. I try. Like, well, it's because I'm learning too, right?
Yeah, that's how
and
I
we're
feel.
All learning.
That's what how I feel. We're all learning, so we all got to ask the question that the person who is too shy to ask won't ask.
You know what keeps me in check, though?
What?
This is going to sound funny, but to my girlfriend, all the stuff I go and do, like, you know, going out in the hacker community, going to conferences and all that. It's not, she's not a technical person. So all the stuff's not all that cool to her. And everything I'm doing is like one step above, pick your like fringe alternate interest here. Because I don't want to, you know, I think anything's cool. I'm that kind of guy, you know, so I'm all for it. But, you know, to her, it's just as cool as if I were going to like Star Trek conventions or Star Wars conventions and speaking. It's like, okay, whatever. I used to bartend, you know, you go do that. And that mildly keeps me in check, I think. It's just like, if I go to like a dinner party with like her friends, I mean, they're going to be like, that's kind of interesting what you do. But overall, it's more curiosity than, oh my God, that's so cool.
Yep.
So.
Now, Rafael, we have to ask this because we are Coding 101, because we teach beginning programmers how to get into this, because we try to get people excited about programming.
Sure.
Let me ask it in two parts. The first part is what advice would you give to a beginning programmer when he or she is just starting out to make their code more secure? What do you think is one of the biggest mistakes that they'll make that they'll regret once their code base starts getting attacked?
Okay, so the biggest mistake in terms of security side that a novice programmer will make is putting their code on the internet.
Oh, that is so true.
Oh, wow, you just... okay. Gauntlet has been thrown.
So don't open source your stuff before you know that it's secure.
But wait a minute. I thought open source was always supposed to be good, right?
Oh, open source is fine. It depends on who's looking at it.
Wow. Okay, so that's so you're telling our novice programmers don't ever let anyone look at your stuff.
No, what I'm saying is
actually... We've been telling everybody to share it on the Google Plus
community.
No, I'm not.
I'm sorry.
One, don't put your new novice code in production on an internet server that has data people care about. That's for one. Two, I recommend getting familiar with like the best practices of something, because let me give you an example. PHP is a good example. PHP... Years ago, there was a lot of example code on how to do SQL queries, right? And it would just be like, hey, concatenate this stuff together into a string and pass it to this function, and voila, there's your SQL query. And that was the way to do it. And that community as a whole didn't understand the risk of SQL injection. And now, newer material always takes that into account. So be aware of the maturity of security practices in terms of what kind of framework or project you're working in. And along those lines, you guys just finished a Perl module, right?
Right.
8 lessons on Perl?
Oh, yeah. That was today. Yeah. Well, no. Yeah. That was last week.
Last week.
That was last week we finished.
In the time machine, yes.
In the time machine, yeah.
So
in the TARDIS.
Perl. When I was doing Perl in the late 90s, I was writing web applications in Perl, and I didn't think about code like command injection. I didn't think about all these different ways somebody could hack my application. I guarantee about everything I wrote, including an e-commerce site in 2000, were Swiss cheese and just ripe for being broken into. Why? Because as a whole community of programmers, we just didn't understand best practices. And I think awareness of that is different today in 2014, or should I say 2015 for when this airs?
All right. Rafael, the other side of that question is, if you were giving lessons to a novice and trying to encourage him or her in the field of programming, and they showed an inclination towards security work,
okay,
what advice would you give them? What should they look at? What should they read? What should they watch?
Our show, obviously.
Yes. We'll that. And your talks, obviously. Yes. But
oh, okay. So somebody who's got inclination for programming and they're really interested in security, what would I steer them towards? Okay, well, first, security is really broad, so it's going to depend on what their interests are. But let's say they tend towards more system stuff. Like they like digging into the operating system, like digging into like ways that can be abused. I would steer them towards learning a good, like a systems language really well and learning how to interact with the operating system. So I would steer them towards, hey, learn C, okay? And dig as deep into that, actually have a project, have something in mind you want to produce, because it's very easy to passively take in a lot of things to read on stuff. But until, like for me, unless I go do it, I know I don't actually pick it up. I don't actually internalize it. And so for anybody learning programming, security or not, I would always steer them towards have a project.
Be project oriented. I think that's actually incredibly good advice. Good advice because, again, that gives you the constraints and that gives you something to focus on. That's fantastic. Rafael Mudge, we want to thank you for being on this episode of Coding 101, on this wildcard episode. It's always nice to speak with people who are actually doing this for a living because it's a different point of view from just showing off code. You're someone who's actually taken this and made quite a name for himself. Once more, can you please tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find your work, and maybe where they could find your speaking schedule so that they can check out your next talk?
Sure. Okay, so if you want to find my grammar checker, go to www.afterthedeadline.com.
All right.
See, I had to throw a curveball in there. No, okay, so if you want to learn about what I'm doing in the hacker community now, go to, see, there's After the Deadline. That's mine. Go to www.advancedpentest.com, and that's Cobalt Strike. And you can check out my blog at blog.cobaltstrike.com, and that's where I tend to write something about what I'm doing. And when I plan to give talks, I usually put a plug there as well. And so, yeah, that's pretty much what I'm up to now.
What's next? When will your next big conference be? I know you'll be at Black Hat. I know you'll be at DEF CON, but what's after that?
At Black Hat, actually, I'm going to be in something called the Arsenal, which is like an area for open source developers to talk about stuff. And I'm releasing a project next week, something brand new, designed for novice hackers to learn how to do spear phishing and targeted attacks. And
cool.
It's a virtual machine called Morning Catch. It's really fun. It's like a fake fishing company.
Is
like
this
seafood.
The first time you've told us?
Yeah, I haven't told anybody about it yet.
Oh, I wish this was... Give...
Wait, will this thing be ready to demo at Black Hat?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's ready. It's ready to go now.
Can I film you at Black Hat?
Yeah, please. Come on by.
Can I film you at Black Hat?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. We can, like... We'll rent a room, make it a whole little studio, all that good stuff.
That's awesome, dude. Congratulations.
Oh, yeah. No, it's just something fun. You know, I like to keep putting stuff out in the community. I think that's really important to do.
I agree.
Fantastic. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Rafael, no matter what show you're on, be it Twiat, Hack 5, or now Coding 101. I'm going to tap you on the shoulder for a future project that we want to do with Coding 101. We want to do something a little sinister.
Ooh, I like sinister.
But legal, but totally legal.
Aww.
Oh, well, Andrew. All right. Shannon and I, we're out. We're not doing that. I mean, yes. Be cool. Follow the rules. Look both ways when you cross street. Eat your vegetables and brush your teeth.
We thank you for joining us, especially so late at night. You know, I know it's really late. It's what, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock where you are? No, it's 11
it's midnight.
O'clock. It's midnight
I'm
where you are.
I'm happy, man. I haven't slept this week, and so that's why I feel like so crazy.
And I hate to tell you this, but you're not sleeping next week either.
No, I know. It's going
to
be tough.
But I'll see you in Las Vegas. I'll take you out to some sushi. How about that?
I'd love it.
Fantastic. Rafael Mudge, again, find him at his website. Find him on his Twitter account, Armitage Hacker, and definitely find him at Black Hat and DEF CON. Well, that's about it for this episode of Coding 101. We want to thank you for joining us for this wildcard episode. We will be back next week in the time machine with another wildcard episode before we jump into the next programming language. That's right,
in the TARDIS.
But Shannon, if they wanted to find out a bit more about our show, where should they go?
If you want to find out more about Mudge or about the show or find our show notes and all of our coding, you can find that over at twit.tv/twitcoding101.
That's right. And also, you've got to join our G+ group.
Yes.
Just search for Coding 101. You're going to find it. It's a nice place to go if you're a beginner, if you're intermediate, if you're an expert programmer, because there's always a need for all of you. Every time someone asks a question in that community, it spreads knowledge. And we're all about spreading the knowledge. Now, if you don't like Google+, you can also find us on Twitter. You can find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ.
Yep. And I am at Snubs. That's at Snubs.
At Snubs. And don't forget that this show goes live. Actually, well, most weeks this show goes live. You can find us 2:30 p.m. on Thursdays. That's Pacific
1:30.
Time. I'm sorry, 1:30 p.m. It's late. 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Thursdays at live.twit.tv. And as long as they're there.
And, yeah, we have a chat room going. We read it throughout the show. So if you guys have any questions or if we accidentally skip over something while we're showing you guys a certain programming language, definitely ask it in the chat room in the IRC. That is over at irc.twit.tv.
Absolutely. Until next time, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend some deep quality time with all you out in the internets. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Balasair.
I'm Shannon Morse.
End of line.
End of line.